I suppose technically today is kind of like my Monday. Although on Monday I was a lawyer, so. All right. So much to do, so little time. Matthew made it in at some point. Blake is now here. Looking like he's ready. No, wait, you're Garrett.
Blake.
You're Blake. Okay, so you're over there. I'm just going to do that so I don't confuse the crap out of myself. Because it's easy to do. Maya is here. She dropped out, which is fine. Joe is here. Madeline is back. All right, so... lots to do, little time to do it. We will be having our first exam at the end of this week, possibly on the weekend. It will be an online exam that will be done through Engage. If you've scrolled down to the bottom where the exams are, the directions are pretty straightforward. Most of the exam is made up of multiple choice, and there are two essays on there. I do it this way to give you extra credit, like a bonus question. Unfortunately, Engage, unlike Blackboard, I can't dedicate a question to be an extra credit question. So, what does that mean? Well, in terms of points, if you get a perfect score on the exam, you can get up to 110. So that's like an A++++. But because there are two essays on there, you basically have the option. You don't have to answer two if you don't want to. Just keep in mind the second one is technically a bonus question. So if the first one comes up and you don't like the option, because within each essay there are options available. So I let you pick your own essay. There's three or four or five essays in each one. So you pick one of those and that's what you answer. So if the first question comes up and there's nothing you like, you can skip it and go to the next one when the next one appears. Of course, the challenge about the test is that one question appears on the screen at a time. Everything is completely randomized. So you could go 30 questions of getting all multiple choice and then get the essays at the end. Or you could be like someone who was just like, oh, whining about it last semester. They got both essays in the first two questions. But hey, at the end of the day, it is what it is. You'll have an hour to do it. You're not allowed to backtrack. So if you skip a question, it's wrong. If you get kicked out, you can't get back in. That's the way Engage works. You'll have to take the whole exam over again. So you'll have to contact me and say, Professor, I got kicked out. And fine, we'll figure out another time for you to take a makeup. I mention that because we all know that Wi-Fi on campus at times is spotty. So as I always tell students, before you start the exam, make sure you're in a place that has stable Wi-Fi. Such as like Info Commons or something like that. And do it on like one of the desktops down there as opposed to trying to do it on your phone. It'll make life a little easier for you. But I will let you decide if we can get... I'm going to fly through what we got. So I will let you decide on Thursday what day you want to take the exam on. And we will do it by vote. You'll be able to take it on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. But it will be your choice. So the other two classes, they had less for the first exam. They took their exams. Both of them voted for Saturday exams. But again, I'm going to leave it up to you. It's going to be your choice. But we'll talk about that on Thursday. How did I do, Zaria? Did I touch upon everything for the exam? Feeling good now? All right, that's what I like to hear. All right, consequences 100 years war. Let's get through this real quick. These are not necessarily points that are going to be on the exam. These are just things that I kind of want to drill into your head because we're going to come back to the political development of what occurred in England and in France, and what ended up occurring in those nations was definitely a consequence of the Hundred Years' War. One of the biggest things is this point. England would develop and France would develop on a different course politically, economically, socially, than they had been prior to the Hundred Years' War. On the English side, the English kings were weakened. Part of the reason why is because of Magna Carta. That's the reason why I threw it in. beginning at the very outbreak of the war, the first king, Edward III, had to convene a gathering of the nobles, which was called Parliament. Because under Magna Carta, the king could not raise taxes. The kings had to get the consent of the barons. So, in Parliament, Parliament decided, are we going to give the king tax money? If Parliament didn't vote for tax money, what would have happened to the war effort? Yeah, can you fight a war without any money? No, so the irony is that one of the things that the Parliament began doing was demanding that the king recognize certain laws, certain rights, certain privileges. Because the Parliament basically said, okay, let's do this quid pro quo game. This would be a significant development because essentially what would end up happening is Parliament and the lower chamber, the House of Commons, would begin to emerge as a legislative branch. Never before in the history of European development was that principle that we call separation of power, where there was one group that made the laws and another group that enforced the laws. And, well, Edward III, I talked about Edward III. The more that the kings demanded, the more issues were codified. More complaints, grievances that the nobles or the commoners had that had to be passed into law. And ultimately, there was nothing the kings could do about it. They were desperate. As we're going to see, this would give rise 150 years later to a controlled monarchy, where the powers of the king are limited in a constitution, and that there are checks and balances in that system. Of course, ironically, there would be many European countries that would look to these historical events and the justification and the developments and would attempt to follow along those paths. The irony in France, the exact opposite occurred. In France, the monarchs would become more powerful. Part of the reasons why was the devastation that was caused in France. That's one thing to remember about the Hundred Years' War. Not a single battle was actually fought in England. All of the battles were fought in France. And as a result, France was devastated. So this devastation would in the short term lead to political instability. There was absolute chaos that threatened the whole system itself, that feudal monarchical system. We talked about what happened to King John II. King John was captured, was held prisoner in England. And when that occurred, this essentially was a vacuum. No one was in charge. And chaos, to a degree, ensued. There was outward rebellion, and there was more devastation in France. But in sheer luck, the nobles decided to join with the Dauphin, the prince, and essentially steamroller any attempt by commoners to get the same types of rights that the commoners in England began demanding. And of course, we can't forget the whole reign of Charles VI. He was insane. Let's not forget, it was that king, Charles VI, that agreed to the Treaty of Troyes, which almost resulted in a victory for the English. But ultimately, it was due in part to Joan of Arc's assistance that Charles VI's son, Charles, the Dauphin, was crowned at Reims, becoming Charles VII. And it was Charles that ultimately began turning the tide of the war. The people began to rally to him, and he rolled over the English. And he fought a war of nationalism. First time it was documented or alluded to in European history. Charles referred to his people as the French people, and the enemy were the English, a distinct separate race, us versus them. As a result, whereas in England the powers of the king were stripped, in France, people turned to the king, wanted the king to be like a great protector. They saw the crown as a unifying force, protecting the people from the merchants and the foreigners. So as a last click, as we're going to see when we go back to France, particularly during the reign of Louis XIII and Louis XIV, whereas the English monarchy would be weakened, the French rulers would use history to their advantage, making themselves more and more powerful, to the point where when we talk about Louis XIV, the Sun King, we're going to see one of the most powerful monarchs ever to live. He literally had control over the lives of every man, woman, and child in his country. He controlled their jobs. He controlled where they lived. He controlled everything. Had it not been from Joan of Arc, the English might have won, and history might have been different from France. But that's the funny thing about history. You go back, you look at it, you follow the steps, and you use it as a guide on what not to avoid or how to avoid the bad things. Of course, the funny thing is about the French is they kind of loved having an all-powerful ruler, even though they had the French Revolution, that's what we're going to leave off with in this class. But, you know, they would eventually vote for the rise of Napoleon, and then they would vote for the rise of Napoleon III. So, like, the French people, yeah, they wanted freedom, they wanted rights, but at the same time, they wanted an all-powerful monarch. So, and to a degree, you can see that in public opinion polls in America. There's a lot of Americans that would gladly give up their freedoms to an all-powerful federal government because the all-powerful federal government would protect them and keep them safe. All right, questions? All right, let's move to a different type of topic. We've talked about 200 years of political and military and economic chaos. Let's talk about a different type of chaos. And this involves none other than the Holy Roman Catholic Church. At the same time, the plague, 100 years war, Mongolians, and that's the thing, all of this stuff was going on at the same time, another major crisis took root. And that would be the subjugation of the Catholic Church itself. Now, we're not going to talk about theology. We're not going to do any biblical stuff. This is all pure politics. Because the Babylonian captivity was triggered by an actual political battle between the Pope at the time, Boniface VIII, and a French king that we alluded to, Philip IV. And what was at stake? Taxes. Taxes. Could the crown tax the church? Could the crown tax the church? All right. What triggered this event was debt. France had huge debt problems. France as we know in the 13th century had been engaged in fighting many, many wars. Wars against England, but they were also fighting wars against the Spanish. They were fighting wars against the Belgians. They were involved in crusading efforts. Some of the last crusades. There was just huge debt. So, the crown had to deal with the fact that the debt was four times the total government's revenue. They owed four times as much money than the government took in taxes on an annual basis. So when you are that in debt, what do you, as a leader of a country, do? First off, what's the problem of being in debt? You don't have money to spend. Yeah, exactly. So what happens if another war breaks out? Right. What about credit? Because obviously if there's debt, that means they had to go to people to borrow. What about creditors? Are they going to be able to get any more loans? Or if they're able to get loans, what are the interest rates going to be? Yeah, high, exactly, because they're a credit risk. So the crown needed to find a source to tap so it could pay its bills. By the way, guess what's going to happen at some point in your lives when the federal government seeks to address the fact that our country is $33 trillion in debt? You know what they're going to do? They're going to take away people's 401ks, their life savings. They're going to impose more and more taxes because the government can't print paper. They have obligations to pay, and you guys are going to pay for it, as are your kids and your grandkids. But in this particular instance, the crown got creative. They looked at the fact that the Catholic Church had an annual revenue 60% higher than the annual revenue of the French government. They saw literally wagon loads of money leaving France going to Rome. So, in 1296, Philip came up with a great idea. To help the French nation pay its bills, to help the French kings keep the French people safe, they would impose a 50% tax on the church. Now, I'm not going to claim poverty. France at this point, about a third of the lands was actually controlled by the church. Some of the most lucrative businesses in France were monasteries, where things like beer and wine were produced. That was owned by the Catholic Church. Plus, any of you Catholics? Any of you Catholics? Well, if you're a Catholic, you go to Mass. Every single Mass, a basket gets passed around. There's an expectation that you contribute to the good of the church. So at the time, the expectation was people give up to one-third of their annual income in gifts to the Catholic Church. So the church had megabucks. And even though it was supposed to go to the good works of the church, most of it was going to Rome. So the king declares that all revenue generated by the church in France has to, or is going to be met with a 50% tax. Half of it has to go to the government. Well, in response to this measure, the Pope responded with a papal bull. Clarissimus Laetius, which means the clergy and the laity, or the lay people, or the commoners. The clergy and the commoners. This was an order to the priests, to the bishops, to the cardinals, and the people of the church not to comply. Not to comply. The Pope says that no member of the church shall turn over what was defined as church property, thus the property of the Pope himself, to any secular government. Oh, and he also added the church's favorite weapon. If you disobey, what's the consequence? No, well, before you get to hell, something has to happen to you first. You have to get kicked out of the church, and if you can't go to church, then you go to hell. So if you actually give money to the government, that's the church's money, you are kicked out of the church. You are excommunicated. Which, of course, set up an interesting situation. Who do you obey? Do you obey the Holy Father? Or do you obey your secular Lord? Bringing up an interesting question. Which is more powerful, the cross or the sword? Well, in response, the king, who was very intelligent, got clever. Fine. You're not going to let us tax your revenue? What are coins made out of? Silver and gold. Commonly referred to as bullion. So in retaliation to this papal bull, the king turns around and says it's illegal to export the things that the coins are made out of. So not that it's money, not that it has value, but it's illegal to export silver or gold. Metal out of France. And in doing so, Philip essentially cuts off 100% of church money leaving France. Because there was no paper money back then. Money was either a gold coin or a silver coin. Well, because France was the largest nation, because much of the church revenue that the church depended upon came from France, this had a crippling effect on the church intake. So, in the end, Boniface realized better to get half than nothing. Out of fear that the entire system would crumble. Because if Philip got away with this, what would stop John in England or the kings of Aragon in Castile or all of the German states from suddenly turning around and saying, well, we got bills to pay too. One of the biggest concessions that both agreed to was that this would be a temporary tax. It would only be implemented for 1 year to help the French government pay its bills. It seemed as if the crisis had passed. But fast forward 5 more years to 1301. In 1301, the king orders the arrest of a bishop in France who used the pulpit to criticize the crown. He criticized the king as a man, as a leader. But there's a law that makes that type of behavior illegal. What's that law called? When you go against the crown. That's called treason. And what's the punishment for treason? Death. So a bishop, we're not talking like a monk. We're not talking a friar. We're not talking a preacher. We're talking a bishop who is a significant, powerful officer in the church, is arrested and charged with treason and is going to potentially face execution for those crimes. Which is mightier, cross or the sword? So in response, the Pope calls all of the French cardinals to Rome, requesting they give him an update on what is going on in France. But Philip counters by holding a grand gathering called an Estates General, in which representatives of the nobles and the church and the commoners were to gather and kind of be a sounding board for the king. It wasn't a legislative body. It wasn't like Parliament. But going back to ancient times, the king could call this Estates General and just get advice, which caused contention. Who are the French cardinals and bishops going to listen to? Are they going to stay in France and go to the Estates General? Or are they going to leave France and go to Rome? In the end, the French bishops and cardinals stayed in France. Heard the issue over the bishop who was charged with treason. And in the end, they sided with the king, saying that the bishop did in fact commit treason and should be executed. In response, Boniface would retaliate with one of the most famous of all papal bulls to come out of the Middle Ages. More famous than any of the other four or five bulls I've sent your way so far. Unam Sanctum. The one holy church. Unam Sanctum. The one holy church. This one bull, and we know what a papal bull is, right? What's a papal bull? Church law. In this document, the Pope transforms the very nature of the church itself into something that it had never been before. Una Sanctum. Boniface states, that God, as the creator of all things, through his Son Jesus, ordered the creation of the church. Saint Peter, after all, was charged by Jesus with founding God's church on earth. Because of this, the church sits above everything. Both the secular and the spiritual. Although the secular is commonly referred to as temporal. In other words, not only does the church control the path to heaven, But the church is also charged with making the rules out of which everybody must obey in their daily lives. The church essentially is an empire. Because it comes from God, the head of the church, the Bishop of Rome, the Holy Father, the Pope, is essentially God's representative on earth. Ipso facto, the Pope controls both. And who must obey?
Everybody.
Unless you want to go where? Yeah, unless you want to go to hell. If you want to go to heaven, you must obey the will of the Pope. If you do not, you will be denied access to the church. In other words, you're excommunicated. And the result is the eternal flame. In it, with reasonable specificity, the Pope essentially dictates that Philip IV, for charging a bishop who is a member of the church with treason, he is excommunicated. And guess who is also therefore excommunicated? Anyone who obeys the king. Powerful, powerful words. Words that had never been issued by the church before or since. But this changes the game. Questions. If you attempt the extra credit questions, it's in the reader. There's excerpts of it. You also can do a Google search of all of these bulls. All right, so now I got to ask you the simple question, which is in fact mightier. The cross or the sword? The here and now, the temporal, or the spiritual? Well, the Pope is saying it's the church, the spiritual. In effect, that is more powerful. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon your perspective, the king, in the end, would prove Boniface wrong. He hires an army of mercenaries who travels to Italy. They attack the town of Ancony, where the Pope had a villa, like a country house. They plunder the Pope's palace. They seize the Pope. They hold him prisoner for 3 days. They subject the Pope to physical abuse. And then they let him go. Shortly thereafter, the Pope would die from the injuries that he sustained while in captivity. Talk about the mafia. Which is more powerful, the cross or the sword? The cross uses words, but the sword, well, they use other things. But this was a huge controversy. This rippled across the continent. Because of the actions of a king, a pope is dead. The head of a church, dead, killed by the head of a nation, the most powerful nation. Well, with the vacancy, in the papacy, the conclave of cardinals gathers, as they do every time there is a dead pope or a vacancy created by resignation, although that's only happened a couple of times in the history of the church, and they elected a successor. In October 1303, the College of Cardinals elects Benedict XI to become the new pope. And he sits back and he says, okay, my predecessor had a quarrel with the king and ended up dead. Any of you have a death wish? Well, neither did the pope. So what does the pope do? Well, he quickly releases Philip from excommunication. He declares that Una Sanctum did not directly refer to the king. So the king is welcome to come back to church. But someone had to be blamed, because after all, the pope was dead. So Benedict, trying to walk a fine line, declares that it was the mercenaries who killed the pope who are at fault, and they are excommunicated. The only problem is amongst the band of the mercenaries was one of Philip's noble advisors and good friends of the king's. Well, everything seemed fine for the time being until July 1304 rolls around, and lo and behold, Benedict XI turns up dead from poison. You want to talk about gossip? It's kind of like if it sounds like a duck and it looks like a duck, chances are, what is it?
A duck.
We have a king that has now killed not one, but two popes. Thus, firmly establishing, in fact, that the sword, at least in the temporal realm, is mightier than the cross. And then, in 1305, in hopes of avoiding the fate of his two predecessors, the new pope, Clement V, bows down before the king. He does two things. First, he repeals Una Sanctum. He issues another bull saying that that is no longer the law of the church. This is no longer the case. That the spiritual and the temporal are a partnership. But he then does something unprecedented. He declares he's moving his court to France. And now the heart of the European church, the Catholic Church, is no longer going to be Rome, is no longer going to be Italy, but it's going to be Avignon in France. This, my friends, would last for 70 years. And this is what church scholars have come to refer to as the Babylonian captivity. Any of you ever read the Old Testament? Does anyone know what the Babylonian captivity in the Old Testament refers to? No? In the Old Testament, the Hebrews were captured by the ancient Babylonians. The kingdom of Israel was destroyed. That's when 12 of the tribes of the Hebrews disappeared to history. But one of the tribes was brought back to the capital, Babylon, and held subjugated for 70 years until the emergence of the great Persian king, Cyrus, captured Babylon and let the Hebrews go home. Well, for all sakes and purposes, for the next 70 years, just like the Hebrews were held captive by the kings of Babylon, the church was literally held as a captive of the French court. For the next 70 years, every single pope would be French. They would have connections to whoever the French king was at the time. And they did not interfere in secular affairs. The kings were allowed to do whatever they wanted. Of course, this is also contemporary with the outbreak of the Hundred Years' War. So the European Pope, the Pope of the Catholic Church, was in France during the first two mini wars, was in France during the outbreak of the bubonic plague, was in France when the Mongolians pushed into the continent. But here's the bizarre thing about the period of Babylonian captivity. There's no works of scholarship. There's no theology. There's no dogma. There's no religiosity. The only thing that the church focused on during these 70 years was money-making schemes. How do we generate revenue? Much of which was brought into the church and then funneled to the French kings. Corruption. Now, it's during this time that two of the most reprehensible practices of the church would appear and would become common. And when we get to the Protestant Reformation, these were things that none other than Martin Luther openly criticized. Well, one of the first was the sale of indulgences. We know what an indulgence is, right? Covered this. What's an indulgence?
It's like a free pass of sin.
Yep. So the church has always used indulgences, but they were always deemed to be gifts. So the Pope could tap the surplus grace, the good things that all of the saints and churchly people do. The Pope could tap that and use some of that good energy and help you get out of hell, or maybe shorten your time in purgatory. It's not necessarily a get out of jail completely free card, but what it's going to do is it's going to limit the time before you can ascend into heaven. We already know in the Crusades how indulgences were used. If you go and you fight your crusade, you get an indulgence. So all of the sins that you did were wiped away. And then later, you could get an indulgence if you simply gave money to the cause. Or you could get an indulgence if you kill people in the name of the church. Well, up to that point, they were always given. They were dispensed. But during the Babylonian captivity, the church realized, people would pay for these things. People would pay. And who would pay? Well, anybody. Because any of you want to go to hell? Or do anyone want to see a loved one go to hell? How much money would you give to avoid going to hell? Because again, your time on earth is finite. You're only going to be here for an X amount of time. You only have so many days to live. And at some point, you're going to die. But how long would a sentence in hell be? Forever! So how much would you pay to get out of it? Would you give $1? Would you give 10? Would you give 100? Give 1,000? Would you give 1,000,000? So the church began hiring what were called peddlers. People who were like traveling salesmen that would go village to village, and they would sell these scraps of paper that had the blessings of the Pope, supposedly. Each one supposedly was personally blessed by the Pope. Did it actually happen? Probably not. Maybe there was like a grand ceremony and the Pope did one of these over them. But we have no idea of knowing. But people bought them up. And the coins began to flow to Avignon. The other thing that the church began to do was to sell entry into the church itself. To sell church offices, which were called benefices. So, bishoprics, abbots, high-ranking officials. Could literally those positions could be bought. So if you were a noble and you had, say, three or four sons, only the firstborn's going to get your stuff. So what do you do with the rest of your kids? Well, you buy them these gigs. They could become the head of a monastery. They could make tons of money selling beer, selling crops. You could make them a bishop. Allow them to skim out of the buckets that are being donated to the church. And hand in hand with this is the practice of pluralism. If you had enough money, you could buy multiple jobs. You could become the abbot at a dozen monasteries. You could be the bishop in three or four bishoprics. The sky was the limit. How much money are you willing to buy or give to the church to get these jobs? But what I'm talking about is outward bribery. Corruption. But if you had enough money, the sky was the limit. Now, obviously, this hurt the credibility of the church. Because soon, you had men who became abbots or bishops, even cardinals, and potentially were on path to become the Pope, who were not qualified, who were not men of God, didn't read the Bible, didn't understand the church's mission. They were nothing but corrupt government officials. And all the while, people were sitting back going like, huh. One of the greatest examples of this occurred during the outbreak of the bubonic plague. The Pope is sitting in Avignon. He gets word that this dread disease has come to France, that it's killing one-third to half of the people. Dead from this mysterious disease. People begin sending requests to the Pope to go out and tend to his flock. But what did the Avignon Pope do? He ordered his tower to be surrounded by wood and furniture. And a fire was maintained. So if anyone attempted to come near the Pope, go to where the Pope was living, just to get a blessing, they would be met by fire and death. Because the Pope was more interested in saving his own butt than tending to his flock. Also keep in mind, they're in France during the outbreak of the Hundred Years' War. There's violence, there's battles, there's death. Did the Popes try mediating? Did the Popes try bringing peace? No. The Pope will bless whoever gives them the most money. So if the English are seemingly winning and they're making lots of money, if they give the biggest donation to the church, then suddenly the church is on the side of the English. That is until the French come back down and take over Avignon again. And then at that point, suddenly, we've always been for the French. The church could be sold to the highest bidder. But every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And as a consequence of the corruption of the church, another weird thing occurred. people begin demanding that the church reform itself. That the church goes back to Jesus' original intent, original message. That the church is not an empire. That the Pope is not an emperor. But the church is supposed to be the vessel to help the believers get into heaven. And that's it. But before the reform movement could get rolling, another bad thing hit the church. There would be a division. Again, not meaning to sound like a broken record. Same time Mongolian, same time plague, same time Hundred Years' War, same time Babylonian captivity. The Catholic Church would rip itself into multiple pieces. There would be a schism, a division within the church. What triggered it was a demand by many Catholics in the continent of Europe who could see how corrupt it was, the church being in France under the thumb of the French kings. People began demanding that the church goes back to where the church is supposed to be. Goes back to Rome. Some German lords, some English lords, Italians threatened to withhold donations to the church. They were serious. Because they believed that Rome was the God's shining city on the hill. So, after 70 years of the being controlled by the kings of France, in 1377, the Pope Gregory XI agrees, he hears the calls, and he decides now is the time. During the second mini-peace in the Hundred Years' War, to move the church court back to Rome. Bless you. Unfortunately, Gregory was old. He was 70 at the time, in poor health, and shortly after he moves his court back to Rome, he dies. Now, FYI, Gregory XI is the last French pope. He's not the last man to call himself pope, but he is the last legally recognized French pope. So if you think about it, it's now 2024. Because of the Babylonian captivity and because of the corruption, there has not been a man from France who has been pope since. So, the conclave gathers, and they choose one of their cardinals to be the new pope. Urban VI is elected. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon your politics, while the conclave was gathering, a mob of Romans appeared on the streets and riots began breaking out. The mob demanded that the Pope be Italian because every Pope up to the Babylonian captivity had been Italian. So Urban was chosen by the conclave. But let's just say, potentially, under duress. Because if the conclave, say, elected another Frenchman, or a German, or an Englishman, or a Spaniard, what potentially could happen to those cardinals when they walked out onto the street? Yeah. They could be attacked by an angry mob. So if you are forced to do something under threat of violence, is your decision true? Is it truly your intent? So this became a big issue. So let's put that as a placeholder. Now, good, bad, right, wrong. Urban was actually a good choice to become pope. He had excellent intentions. He was a true man of the church. He joined as a priest. He became a scholar. He rose through the ranks on merit. And he listened. He heard about all of the complaints about the corruption of the Babylonian captivity. He heard of the stories of the cardinals and the popes getting fat, eating meals with 10 courses, wearing the finest silks, furs, living in palaces, while one-third to one-half of the European population died in the Black Plague. And thousands of others died because of the Little Ice Age. And thousands of others died because of war and chaos and death and destruction. But what about the men of God? What about the men of church? The church? Their bank accounts weren't hit. Their lifestyles were not impacted. And Urban began asking simple questions. If you claim to be a man of God, how can you sit back while your people suffer? So, he began to push for reforms. He began literally preaching to the cardinals, telling them that you shouldn't have to give gifts to get church services. That you should get jobs because you're qualified, not because you have lots of money. And if you got a job, you shouldn't have multiple jobs. You should do your job. The church should not be a luxury resort. Now, here's the thing. He's 100% right. 100% spot on. But the people here, he begins criticizing top down the very people who put him in office to begin with. Cardinals, mostly who were corrupt. Cardinals who mostly got their jobs because daddy bought them their gigs. Cardinals that were big and fat, wore fine silks and robes and furs, owned whorehouses and brothels, engaged in extramarital affairs, fathered bastard children. These cardinals were not true men of God. So the moment the Pope begins criticizing them, they sit back and are like, yeah, you're not going to mess with our deal. The cardinals began claiming he's drunk with power. So, they begin conspiring against the Pope. And they do something that has never occurred before in the history of the Catholic Church. The cardinals, meeting outside of Rome, in the village of Fondi, away from the mobs of the Roman people, away from the riots, away from the threats of violence, make a vote, and they vote to remove the Pope. They claim that their vote was invalid because of the mob, that they only voted for Urban because they were threatened life and limb. Now, this true vote is pure. And what do? Well, they elect a cousin of the French king. Man, who would be the first anti-pope, who would take the name Clement VII. Clement would go back to Avignon and would declare that Avignon is the seat of the church. But here's the thing. There's nothing in the laws of the church that says that the council of cardinals, the conclave, can remove a pope. They only elect the popes. So now we have a situation where, for the first time in history, when Pope Urban says, yeah, I'm not stepping down, you have two men claiming to be the pope. You have two literal heads of the Catholic Church. Urban technically is the pope. Clement is technically the anti-pope. But both claim to be the head of the church. And here is the huge conundrum. Which pope do you follow? Well, as it turns out, this, again, has nothing to do with religion. This is all politics. The kingdoms of Scotland, France, Aragon, Castile, Naples, Sicily, they all side with the Avignon Pope. They claim that Clement VII is the legitimate pope. Whereas, kingdoms of Hungary, Poland, England, Denmark, Sweden, Northern Italy side with Urban. In terms of the Holy Roman Empire, this would be split. Some of the kingdoms went with Avignon, some of them went with Rome. Same thing with Portugal. You literally had the potential for a civil war of sorts. Because if you follow the right pope, that pope is going to get you in heaven. But if you follow the wrong pope, you're going to hell. So what would you do to make sure your pope wins? Literally, localized battles would erupt. And of course, this is at the same time the Hundred Years' War is still going on. It was a mess, and it would remain a mess for 40 years. During which time, multiple anti-popes would be elected and multiple popes would be elected. But it's this that would trigger the last crises. How do we save the church? Questions. All right, you guys are going to get to take advantage of the fact that we got a 75-minute class. Don't have enough time to finish the last subject. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold off, and we're going to deal with the conciliarist movement in the ending of the schism next class. And that will be the last class before the exam. So your homework, obviously, if you missed any classes, is go and listen to the lectures. Make sure your notes are up to date. Start studying. If you're doing any of the extra credit work, answering those questions in the reader, you know, those are going to be due whenever we have exam day. So just tackle some of those if you are so inclined to get extra credit early. And of course, lastly, you got to decide which day of the week you want your exam. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. I'll leave it up to you. All right? Any last minute questions? All right, we'll see you. Stay warm. See you all on Thursday.